We are talking today with an extraordinary young mom. When her husband is unjustly convicted of child abuse and their newborn son is taken away from her, she decides to fight injustice by going to law school and fighting for her husband and people like him. Join us today on Fostering the Future.
Welcome to the Fostering the Future podcast, a show about all things child welfare, dependency, adoption, and foster care. Here are your hosts, veterans in the world of child welfare, Jack and Kat.
We believe that every human has incredible and equal value regardless of what side of the courtroom we sit on. We hope that everyone feels welcome and accepted here on Fostering the Future.
Make sure you follow us on Facebook or Instagram as Fostering the Future Podcast, or check us out on our website at fosteringthefuturepodcast.org.
First thing he said, "Are you and Clayton safe?" And I'm like, "No, we're not. They took him." He literally said, "They told me that they wouldn't take him if I said I did it." Still, after all of this, nothing ever happened. You know, nobody ever fixed it.
How were you? Because you got Clayton back.
I never did know. My parents had to adopt him. So I get to live with him right now, but I got my rights
separated. They terminated your rights?
Yeah.
What were the grounds? Failure to protect?
Mm-hmm. Failure to protect. They didn't really say anything specific. One of the things the investigator said right away is, you know, if you just testify against your husband, we'll give you your baby back. Don't you want your baby?
Oh, yeah. Like you're going to trust them now after what they said to him.
Yeah. Wow. And I was like, my son wouldn't want me to do that. You're asking me to lie under oath to get my baby back. That's against the law. I can't do that. I cannot do that. I cannot testify. You want me to testify against him? It's not going to be against him because everything I know about this man would weaken your case. So why do you want me to testify? Like, I'm not going to sit there and lie and say that he's this person that he's not. He probably at that point would have wanted me to so we could get our son back. But no, I wasn't going to do that. And someday when our kids are old enough, he's going to be happy that his mother stuck by his dad and at the same time fought for both of them. You know, yeah.
Did he ever get out on bail or has he been in jail this whole time?
No. So they set his bond at $75,000 and it was cash only. So he couldn't go through a bonds company. And we fought to get it lowered, but they wouldn't lower it. The judge ended up allowing it to be going through a bonds company. So my grandparents put up their house as collateral and then $7,500.
Yeah.
He did get out. He was in there for like 3 months. We'd started the court process with DCS. So they would bring him down in orange and shackles and handcuffs. And we weren't allowed to talk to him or anything like that.
Which totally corrupts like the opinion of the judge, where every time he sees him, he's in shackles. Initially, he would come shackled.
Yeah.
Then he got bond. How long was he out? Because he did end up getting convicted. Yeah.
He was in for 3 months in jail before we got him out on bond. And then he was out, would have been February of 2018 is when he got out on bond. His trial didn't take place until July of 2019.
He was in a year and a half.
Yeah. And most of that time was going through the DCS court stuff. He wasn't allowed any supervised visits or anything like that. I was given like 4 hours, 2 days a week. And they never really moved it from there. Like usually they do. And it got to the point where like the supervised visit people, like during hearings and when they were testifying and stuff, were crying on the stand saying how great of a mother I am and like how I would be a perfectly fit mother. They didn't listen to them, like literally crying on the sand, emotional.
Wow.
Because they couldn't believe that this was happening to me. But he never got anything to do. They didn't give him anything to do. They But everything that they gave me, we paid out of pocket for him to do, to just show them that he was fighting too. Parenting classes, we both did that. They never signed anything to him. They just kind of like let him attend, but didn't talk to him. Child family team meetings, they would call him the abuser. They wouldn't call him by his name. They would literally like right there. We were sitting.
They wouldn't call him the dad?
No. The abuser is what they would call him. I mean, this was like the whole kind of vibe throughout the whole system. I mean, our first court date in front of the juvenile court judge, and it's literally in the record transcripts. They go to each table and ask if we have anything to say before they begin or whatever. The DCS attorney, he was like, no, I don't have anything to say. The guardian ad litem, the attorney for Clayton, she said, usually I would move to sever right away in a case like this, but I want to dig up some more dirt on the mother first. And so then it got to me and I was like stunned. So I was like, I don't know. I don't have anything to say. And then it goes for him and he says, I just want you to know I'm innocent. I didn't hurt my son. And she said, Mr. Worrell, this is not like criminal court. I don't have to prove that you did anything to take your son away. So from the very moment that we stepped foot into the courtroom, we were like,
it was done.
We're screwed.
So in Florida, we have a privatized child welfare system. Is it the same there or is it all run
state?
State. Okay. So you don't have privatized?
No.
Interesting. Like there's no fall guy for the people that are doing the wrong things. It is literally the state, which also makes it a lot harder to change. Was his conviction before or after the termination of rights?
After. So they did our severance trial before his criminal trial, which was a big thing. And they have what's called a foster care review board before a severance trial. The foster care review board gets all the information, gets to talk to the parents, gets to hear from the attorneys, basically gets to ask questions. We can like say something. And my husband always jokes that like he's not a very good public speaker. And it was the most eloquent thing that he has ever said. But he gave this like little speech in there to them. And they recommended for the judge to wait till after the criminal trial to sever our rights. Because what if he's found innocent and you just severed the rights of parents that you shouldn't have, you know, hold it off, because now it's going to bring up problems if you hold the severance trial before the criminal trial, he's going to have to plead the fifth and everything in the severance trial because he's not allowed to talk without being in his criminal trial because his criminal attorney is saying they're going to use anything against you. And the guardian ad litem in the dependency trial and his prosecutor were in cahoots and they were like always coming to the other court hearings and sitting in and talking to each other.
Wow, really?
Which apparently is totally okay because nobody ever said anything about it. He had to plead the fifth to everything in the severance trial. He only answered one question and it was when one of the DCS attorneys asked, did you hurt your son? And he said, no. Then they asked him to elaborate. Why not? And he said, I plead the fifth. Our whole like kind of strategy going in there was me doing all like the talking or answering their questions and stuff. But a week before the report for our medical expert was ready is when they decided to hold the severance trial and they wouldn't push it back for the medical expert. And so we went in there with nothing. Just ourselves. And then the visit people talking for me and like our family. But that's it. So we had nothing. And so they severed us. But I feel like even if we had the medical evidence at that severance hearing, it wouldn't have made a difference because the judge saw the preliminary, like kind of rough draft report. The final report wasn't done yet. And so we couldn't use it. They wouldn't let us use it. Also, for the first 11 months that Clayton was in foster care. He was in foster care 11 months. They wouldn't give him to my family, my parents, his family. They wouldn't give him to anybody.
Which is supposed to be the first thing they do.
Yeah. And we're native. So Indian Child Welfare Act was in play. My parents had to get an attorney to try to bring some pressure on and they weren't doing it. They said that they thought my family must have been crazy because they were supporting us. They must have been like literally insane.
Okay. Wait. Your child was in foster care in a non-native home?
Yep.
Like, isn't that like huge? Mm-hmm. We're talking about Arizona. Like, it can't be that hard to find a native home.
No. Yeah, they didn't even try. Not at all. And so we were fighting literally for months, 11 months. And it wasn't until they made them, my parents, do two different home studies, counseling, a psychological evaluation, because they must have been crazy for believing me and my husband and still like choosing to talk to us. All of these things they passed with flying freaking colors. And they still were saying no. And so they had to hire an attorney, this tribal attorney, to come in and kind of like put pressure on. But even for like 3 weeks, that wasn't happening.
Aren't there huge consequences for not following? It's ICWA, right?
Yeah.
Like, who's going to hold them accountable for?
Nobody. So that was a big thing. And so she started bringing that up, trying to petition to be joined as a party at one of the child family team meetings. It got figured out. And the only reason they let him have them is because me and Gary had to write a letter agreeing that we would not have any contact with my parents. They had to agree that they would take down all of the pictures of Gary in their house.
Take down pictures? Who the hell do these people think that, like, this is America?
We do it because Clayton be adopted, if not. So they have to do these things.
Yes. You said you did like case plan tasks. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you completed your case plan.
Yep.
What, how could they terminate you when you completed a case plan?
I don't know. I still don't know how they operate things up here differently, because I mean, I was in these parenting classes and stuff. I did parenting classes. I did this like mommy and me class. I did counseling. I did like, well, first an intake and then counseling, the supervised visits. And then he did all of that too. Oh, psychological evaluation, drug tests. Yeah, no, none of it made a difference. But I was in these classes with people, with families, and some of them, I mean, that you go around the circle and it's like, what, why are you here? Some of them like did truly, truly awful things. I saw them get their children.
That's what I'm saying. The whole point of a case plan is no matter how bad it is, we're going to help you rehabilitate. Even if you do something, like you actually do something really horrible to your kids or just don't do something you really have to do and neglect them, you still get the opportunity to get them back by working at case plan. So you worked at case plan. You paid for your husband to do all of the same things. I'm not comprehending how they manage this to TPR you when you completed everything. And to begin with, there's no proof that you did anything wrong. I get failure to protect.
Because I would not divorce my husband and they didn't think that I could keep him safe.
I mean, even if you divorced them, they would have been like, well, you know, to find another reason.
Well, they literally sat around in like a mediation and we explained that we couldn't get a divorce because Gary was like, if that's what it takes to get Clayton back, just do it. And I'm like, no, I was still not okay with it. But we were in this meeting. He says, I will let her divorce me. I will sign for it. If that means that you can sever me and you can give her the rights. And they were like, but we have a covenant marriage, what's called a covenant marriage, which I guess not many people really know about, but like you have, there's special requirements to be able to get like a divorce. Like you have to go through like a whole bunch of like premarital counseling and then you get married. And then there's like requirements for divorce. You can't just like do it because one of you wants to. And so we were like, what should we do about this? You have to be at least like separated for a year with a year of counseling and all this stuff. And they're looking in this meeting, sitting around at the table, and they're looking up loopholes to get out of a covenant marriage. And then one of them finds something and is like, yay, we found something. I'm so excited. Look right here. All you have to do is this. You're laughing and cheering right now because you're so excited that you found a way that you can rip apart my marriage. It was very much, though, like centered on me not leaving him and me standing by his side, me living with him still, living with the abuser. Because she's still living with the abuser, this is why she gets her rights taken away, too.
They sever your rights. He had already moved in with your parents at that time.
I think it was just about the time that maybe a month prior he had moved in with my parents.
How did you get to the point that you're allowed to live there?
I wasn't allowed to until the case was closed, which we appealed it. So the case wasn't closed during that time. I was still able to visit with him and be supervised. It wasn't until both of the appeals failed. And we had one appeal left that we could take it to the United States Supreme Court, but that's pointless. There's like, they take such few cases and hardly ever like family law issues. And his was the only one that really had a good, strong argument, because getting rid of that like fair trial, because he had to plead the fifth. That was an issue that maybe could have went somewhere, but it didn't with the Arizona Court of Appeals. It didn't with the Arizona Supreme Court. And even if it did, it would go back to the same judge to like restart the case, which she would have closed it anyways. Like, again, yeah, she made that decision. Of course, she's going to do it again. So we decided not to, because it was going to be like $45,000 each of us. When it goes to the United States Supreme Court, it's all this like fancy binding that you have to do to make it look like pretty and stuff. Like, it's a lot. And so we decided not to do that. So after that was over, they went through with like the adoption paperwork and did that. That took a couple of months. And then they were able to do that. And so once they were adopted, my parents were asking about it, and they're like, well, do we have to supervise her? And they're like, oh, no, you're good. Like, she's good. She can live with you if you want.
So clearly they had no concern about you the whole time. They were just screwing with you.
Exactly. And they even said, we were like, so what happens if he gets found innocent? What happens when he comes home? They're like, well, you can still like live together. You can just go and move with your parents. They're just the legal guardians. How is that? How can you sleep at night? And we actually got an email from one of our case managers in the DCS, and we had had like three. We had one of them who was very, very supportive of our family. Like, he would come. He was the only one that actually ever came to the house and talked to me and Gary, like would listen, would read reports, like the doctor's reports and stuff, would say how sorry he was. And we get to the severance trial, and he gets up on the stand and he spews bullshit. He starts talking about how obviously Gary abused him and obviously I can't protect him and all of this stuff. So I sent him an email and I said, we would really prefer if from now on you would be honest and upfront with us about your feelings, because we were under the impression that you believed our family. We were under the impression that you were going to advocate for us and you didn't. And he literally said, basically, I'm sorry. I totally understand. You are justified if you hate me. How I had to testify was not how I think of you and your family. So literally admitted to lying in the freaking court record.
Okay, so you know what happened is his boss told him what he had to say.
Exactly.
He said, what I said in court is not how I feel about your family.
Yep. Okay, he said, my message was, Eric, we are doing as well as we can for the situation after how trial went. We would prefer if you'd be more direct in our communication, since the things that were said in trial about us were not aligned with the things that you said to us on your own. It would be appreciated, since we felt very confused and betrayed in the courtroom because of the astronomically different things that were being said in court versus what you've told my family and I in our home. He said, Haley, I appreciate your comments. I do not believe there is anything I can say to help you understand my role. How I feel about you and your family is very different than how I was required to testify as a child safety specialist. And because of that, some of us DCS employees find ourselves in very difficult positions. If you hate me because of the trial, you are completely justified. My best.
Wow.
December 6th, 2018.
I mean, what you and your husband have gone through is insane. Nobody deserves that. It's so unfair. It's so unfair that you had to deal with these things at the age that you were. Well, and I'm going to tell you that people who are much older than you have struggled in the exact same ways, because when someone in a position of authority tells you that you don't have rights, you believe them. And nobody thinks when they go to the hospital with their kid, they need to bring a lawyer or consider those things. And innocent people don't protect themselves.
Yep.
Like, it's not just your age, but at that age, crap, I couldn't get myself to college classes, like, let alone raise a child, let alone like know what to do in a situation like that. That alone, the fact that you have had to do this, so much of this alone while he is in jail, is so unfair. I'm kind of like blown away at the character of your husband, who sat there and as a 20 year old, right? 20 year old boy, because I remember being 20 and
your brain is not even fully developed.
Right. As a 20-year-old boy, to make a choice to sacrifice himself for his wife and his child is like the very model of the opposite type of person that they're trying to portray, which sucks because the position that he's in, because of that, he's put himself like in this position where it's like the lowest of the low, where people like look down on you because you're in jail. And in actuality, he's like the freaking hero in this story here. And that's the thing that like I'm just kind of overwhelmed by, the character of someone who does that. Nobody considered the fact that he had failure to thrive, that you had low D. These are all things that make you go, hey, maybe something else is going on here. Every single kid, man, you wake up in the morning and they've got something swollen and all of a sudden you're in jail. And they use that jail against you in the trial because obviously you can't answer questions. And then they use your dependency against your trial because, oh, if they took their kids away, like clearly he's a bad dude, right? Obviously, I'm deeply sorry that any part of our country allowed like something like this to happen to you and your family. I'm also kind of like really inspired about the way that you have responded after this situation. If you could share a little bit about that, because I am just blown away at this.
And it was actually one of my husband's experts at his trial that kind of encouraged me. It was like good news and bad news. He was telling me, he was a false confessions expert. His name is Dr. Richard Leo. And he was telling me, I don't think this is going to go well, because one of the things is our medical expert disappeared off the face of the planet right before the criminal trial. So we didn't have him there. Couldn't get a hold of him. Nothing. So we went in with no medical testimony. And so he was sitting out with me and my grandparents, me and my grandma, because we were both witnesses. So we couldn't be in the courtroom while the trial was happening until we testified. And he was sitting out there and he said, look, I hate to tell you this, but I think he's going to lose trial. And here's my card. I want you to call me if he gets convicted, and I'm going to help you. And I'm going to help you help yourself. We talked a little bit and just about how these things happen, and they happen all the time and all over the place, is what he kept saying. We didn't know about parents behind the pinwheels. We didn't know about any of this kind of stuff. We thought we were the only case. And so when he started talking about that and saying, you know, this happens all the time, he said he was just trying to be a difference in the system, is what he was trying to do, just be a difference in the system. So I waited through the trial. He got convicted, which the trial is a whole another thing that went wrong. He got convicted. And of course, I was 4 months pregnant at the time and emotional, hormonal wreck. And I decided I could either sit there and I could feel sorry for myself and my family and just like wallow in self-pity. And I allowed myself to do that for like a day and a half. And then I decided that I was going to go to school. And so try to go to law school and like do something about it. And so I went to community college for the first 2 years online, and I got my paralegal associate's degree. And then I transferred to an honors college at Arizona State University and did justice studies for my bachelor's. Through that, I got to take some law classes early. I did my thesis paper on police interrogation tactics and their link to false confessions. I interviewed that same man that was the expert for my husband's trial. I talked to him and interviewed him for it. And so got to work with him on that. Then I got into law school, and I'm in my third year of law school right now. I just finished a research project, a little bit kind of the similar, but a little bit more on depth of like the gamesmanship of police interrogations. And I cite a quote from the Arizona Supreme Court where they say that some forms of police gamesmanship can be tolerated during interrogations. And so that like just secures the fact that this is a game. It was a game that ruined my family and put us through so much pain. So yeah, I'm going to be graduating next year. I spent the last year working in the post-conviction clinic at ASU, actually with my husband's attorney is my supervisor. And so I got to work on like 9 different post-conviction cases and represent people on parole hearings and in their PCR petitions, writing, researching, all of that. And I plan to do something in this area. I'm not sure quite yet if I want to do family or criminal yet, but something in that area. And I wrote 2 books about it. Yeah, I wrote one called Confessions of a Prisoner's Wife, and that's like the prison process and how that all feels. And then the other one's called Complications, and that's like me and my husband's story.
And where could people access these?
Oh, Amazon has it, Barnes & Noble.
Looking for it. Is there any hope for getting them out?
Basically, when you get convicted, with a trial, you have to go through an initial appeal. In initial appeals, you can only argue what happened during the trial, that something went wrong. So we did that, and it failed. The attorney's name was Lori, and she was amazing. She's gotten a lot of people, helped a lot of people get out of prison, but she did a great job. But it goes to the Court of Appeals. They said no. And so then we petitioned to the Arizona Supreme Court for review, and they declined to review it. So they don't even have to look at it. And then the next step is what they call post-conviction relief. This is where we argued that there was new evidence, that there was ineffective assistance of counsel, amongst some other things that happened at trial. And his attorney right now is Randy McDonald, and he's amazing. He's my supervisor at the clinic. But we did the genetic testing in this for new discovered evidence, and still, again, mentioned the vitamin D deficiency that we didn't get to bring up in trial. And we ended up getting a oral argument for that, where the judges seemed very interested and seemed to get it. And then they voted against it and denied it. First, the post-conviction petition goes to a superior court judge. It wasn't the same judge that had his trial, although I wish it would have, because I believe that his judge is very fair. And I believe she knew he was innocent, but couldn't do anything about it. So it goes to a judge. She denied it. Then it went to the Court of Appeals. They denied it. Then we took it to the Arizona Supreme Court. We're waiting for that. They most likely will deny it. They don't even have to read it, you know? So we've been waiting on that for like 3 or 4 months.
And judges like to protect other judges' asses.
Yeah. Especially if you rely on people that are in the state of Arizona to check these convictions. Everybody's in Arizona. Nobody wants to admit that they're wrong when they're coming from the state that would be admitted that they were wrong and have repercussions from that. This is the last kind of thing. We're just waiting to hear back. It probably, realistically, it's probably not going to happen. Realistically, he won't get out until December of 2029. He got 12 years in prison, which Arizona doesn't have good time. They only have 85%. So he will be spending a little over 10 years in prison. Wow. He's there like 5 years right now. You have two different kind of options after this is like habeas corpus petition, which is almost impossible to win with the recent Supreme Court decisions that have come down on that. Not much to do. Left.
Okay. But worst case, he gets out in 2029, which is 5 years away. And then when he gets out in 2029 or before, like, he can just live in the house with you and the kids and your parents?
We're not sure about that. We have a new governor. She appointed a new prison director who finally let Clayton come and visit, because for a long time he wasn't. So when Clayton was like 4 years old was the first time that he got to see him since that day at the hospital where he was taken. And it was the most amazing, heartbreaking, but amazing day. It was like no time had passed. Big hugs and crying. And it was amazing. And we go see him every week. He loves seeing his daddy. And we're not positive, but I think we have a good chance of being able to get to live with him. Like, now that he's adopted, there's no like court orders that says that he can't be around him. So we're hoping that by that time, he's going to have enough history of visits, supervised visits with them through the prison. Yeah. And they're going to be old enough to say what they want, that we're hopeful.
But like, stealing 9 years of, you know, his life with his dad is like the worst, man. What can people do to support your family?
Writing letters to the governor. We haven't really like put that much effort into that, but I'm sure that would be something, especially now that we have a governor that actually listens to things like this. For a long time, we did not have one like that. And it was just pointless. I had tried with the other one, but so probably sending letters to the governor. Her name is Katie Hobbs. She's done a lot of wonderful things. She just replaced the head of DCS, who was doing really terrible things. So she's making progress towards things. So I think, but just like spreading awareness, because we don't have too many of these stories coming out of Arizona. And I know that there are. I know a couple families that do, that just, they're so scared to speak up, you know. And if we can be those people that speak up, so happy to be able to do it. But we just got to get some attention. Not a lot of people in this news area in Arizona want to cover things like this.
Somebody who is going through this a little more freshly, who hasn't gotten through to like the trials yet, like, is there any advice that you would leave them?
don't talk to the police without a lawyer. Find a person, message me, find me anywhere on any of my pages and reach out and just like have someone to talk to, because we didn't have that and we didn't know about this stuff. We didn't know it was happening to other people. And I think that the more support that you can have, especially from someone that knows what it's been through, because a lot of family and friends will use silver linings like, oh, I'm so glad that he's with your mom, or you should be so thankful that he's with your mom, and thank God for he's with your mom and stuff like that. And it's just,
you should be so thankful you don't get to parent your kid on your own.
Even well-meaning things, it's just like, can set you off and can cause so much conflict. And it's really good to have someone that knows what you're going through to talk to. It makes a world of difference. So yes.
Yeah, I'm very impressed with the network that y'all have created within yourselves. A lot of families that have gone through Parents of the Pinwheels. These Georgia families are so many of them. They're getting brave, man. They're like putting their big voices on. And I love watching them support each other. But like nobody can understand what it's really like except for y'all. So many of you have like some of these skills that like are so helpful in this situation. Obviously, you with your new legal career, one of the moms is a nurse practitioner. We're making like a task force here. Like they're taking advantage of vulnerable families and stealing their babies and putting their husbands in jail. But like really, they're creating a task force like to fight against them. You don't F with mama bears.
No, you don't.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you subscribe and follow us on social. We hope that you join us again next time and keep on fostering the future.